All right, continuing with YAO 2011, talking to a bunch of speakers and folks. Mike Lee.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Great, man. So tell me a little bit about yourself and what you're talking about here.
Sure. So they call me the mayor of Amsterdam, basically. I've started the nerd homeland in Amsterdam in the Netherlands.
Excellent.
Before that, I took a year-long world tour to find that place. Before
nice.
That, I worked for a small fruit company in Cupertino, some people have heard of. And before that, I was a Silicon Valley entrepreneur, had a couple of startups, co-founded Tapulous, made TapTap Revenge, worked on the Obama iPhone app.
Wow.
And before the iPhone, I worked on the Mac, working on Delicious Library 2.
Nice, man. So tell me about Amsterdam.
Sure. So the idea of Amsterdam basically is to, like I said, create a homeland for nerds, right? A center of gravity for our industry. The way that Hollywood is for movies or Wall Street is for finances, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Something that you think of and associate with the industry. And that's very powerful in a couple of ways. You know, one of the most notable ways is that it enables us to do things as kind of a unified force, right? So, for example, we have this, you know, what they call the patent trolling situation. It's really a lot more like extortion than anything else. You know, which is basically the United States exporting their jurisdiction and having a bunch of guys who have a bunch of vaguely worded patents who are trying to extort money out of people, you know, by basically terrifying them with legal action.
Mm-hmm.
So we've assembled a team of international attorneys to not only represent people who are being harassed by these people, but also to, you know, create information and put that out there just so that people don't have to be afraid of these big nasty letters that they get, so they know what the situation is, they know what their chances are,
mm-hmm.
and they know what needs to happen next. For example, if you're trying to put together a company and you want, shall we say, to protect yourself a bit from the situation, we've worked out with these attorneys, like the best structure for your business, for example.
Mm.
That's one of the types of things that Amsterdam does. We also have a great developer community there, so it really is just the best city in the world to be an app maker.
Tell me about your talk.
So it's called product engineering, right? And product engineering is basically, we have this notion of you have an idea, and then there's some mysterious step two, and then profit. Product engineering is that step two. It's how we take an idea and we turn it into a product. So it's, you know, it's thinking about, first of all, taking that idea, stripping it down to the bare metal, and figuring out what problem we're actually trying to solve so that we can come up with an elegant solution that we can actually ship.
Mm.
Talking about things like how crazy should your idea be? How boring should it be? Looking at some you know, examples. Apple is a really good example. I mean, they do excellent product engineering. Regardless of what you think about the company, they're pretty successful, so they've obviously figured a few things out.
Absolutely.
You know? Looking at, for example, the way that you should do your testing, you know, and a lot of misconceptions about, you know, when to ship, you know, what customer service is all about. I mean, we tend to pass these nuggets of knowledge around in our industry, and really it's about examining those nuggets and figuring out, you know, what do the people who are actually successful know that makes them successful?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, I mean, Apple, for sure, they have the ability to make personal computing devices that are personal.
And right? That's exactly it. It's all about people. And that
yeah.
is the difference between product engineering and most other forms of engineering, is that with product engineering, an overarching form of engineering, you know, you can't just be a product engineer. I mean, you have to have some other kind of engineering skill. I'm a software engineer.
Mm.
But when we talk about software engineering, a lot of times we're talking about people who like computers more than people. People who are trying to come up with cool things and not necessarily to solve society's problems.
Mm-hmm.
But great products don't come from that. Great products come from actually looking at what makes people suffer, finding out a way to make their suffering less,
mm-hmm.
and actually creating an elegant solution that they'll be able to use to actually save them time, save them money, make their lives better.
Interesting. Now, I mean, in some sense, there's a fractal in that. Because as a software engineer, we also like less suffering, less pain, less misery, and personal computing experience from a software development perspective.
Yeah, it's definitely true. But the thing that you have to understand is that we basically have two purposes in the universe, to build and to enjoy. And to build is not necessarily the same as to enjoy. Certainly, we like to say that we enjoy building, and we do. But the reality is there's a lot of suffering that we go through, a lot of pain that we go through that the user never knows, because we protect them from that pain. It's like your parents. You know, your parents suffer in ways that you don't even understand to make your life better. And that's what makes them special to you.
Mm.
That's what a great product should be like.
Excellent. Now, let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, it's one thing to have an idea.
Mm.
Like, oh, I have a great idea
sure.
for, you know, a thing that does this and that and blah, blah, blah. But then there's once you have an idea and then look at this, like, massive black hole of things you're going to need to deal with. Sometimes it's like, whatever. Someone else can take it from here. How do you get past that first step is my question.
You know, it's kind of related to another question that I get asked a lot, you know, from the entrepreneurial sense of when should you start your own business, right? I mean, when should you take your ideas and actually make products out of them? Because we hope that you've had more than one good idea in your life, right? Which ones do you actually keep? And those are the ones that you can't throw away. Those are the ones where you say, somebody else will figure it out. It's too hard a problem. And yet, you can't stop thinking about it. You're waking up at 6 o'clock in the morning instead of your usual 10 because your brain is racing with ideas about how you would implement this thing. You know, everywhere you look, you see the need for it. Everyone you talk to seems to be looking for it. Every implementation you find is poor. And you know inside that you're never going to be able to escape this thing until you get it out and you create it. You want to create products the way Van Gogh created paintings because you have to.
Excellent, man. Now let's step back into your history a little bit. You're a software developer, still are, and you worked on some pretty impressive things you mentioned earlier. Let's step back. How did you get into software engineering? What led you into it? And how did you approach what you just talked about early on? So there's three questions in there. You pick whatever one you want.
Sure. I mean, I think the story of how I became a software engineer in the first place is a really good story.
Great.
Because you know, there's the standard tale. You know, I liked computers, I was in the computer club, I went to college, I got a degree, I had an internship, I got a job with some big company, I went out on my own. And then there's what Neal Stephenson called the long road to engineering. It's a road that's often circuitous and involves suffering and great adventure, but that tends to lead to really great engineering because you tend to have a very well-rounded perspective of the world and therefore a very good understanding of the people that occupy the world. The other thing about the story that I think makes it a great story is that at the end of the day, I'm not particularly special. I'm just a guy who believes that if you're kind to people and you work really hard, that you'll get ahead in life. And the fact that that's actually been true for me is great, because what I don't want is for people to look at me and say, that guy had some advantage or that guy had some innate talent that enabled him to be where he is, and there's no way I could do that. And that's a lie that we tell ourselves. Everybody can be doing what I'm doing. All it requires is knowing what you want and being willing to sacrifice to get that. So where I started was not in engineering at all. I wasn't able to finish college. I didn't have that kind of money. I didn't have the support of my family. You know, I didn't really have a family in the sense that most people think of. You know, there's no place in the world that I can call home where all of my people are, you know. And so I've always just sort of been this person wandering. And I found myself, you know, I grew up in Hawaii, which is a wonderful place, but at the same time, it's a very difficult place to make a living in. And so I left Hawaii. I went to Seattle. And I started working for Alaska Airlines there. And it was, in a certain sense, it was a great job. I mean, I learned so much from that company. It really made me who I am today in a lot of ways. And one of those ways is because it was an incredibly dangerous job, a job with 100% injury rate, where you're told when you start that it's not a question of whether you will be injured. It is a question of when and how badly.
Wow.
I had two coworkers, friends of mine, who actually died at work on the job in the 5 years that I was there.
And what was this?
I was on the ground crew.
Wow.
The ground crew, which means a lot of heavy machinery operated by a lot of angry people on a very tight schedule.
Understood.
And so things go wrong and people get hurt and killed. It's also just a very hard job. I mean, imagine having to stack people's baggage on your knees, unable to even straighten your back because the belly is too small. I mean, the MD-80, for example, the belly is so small I can't even kneel upright in it. So, you know, it takes a toll.
Sure.
And, you know, after 5 years of that, I literally didn't recognize myself. At one point, I was riding on the bus, and I was looking at this old-timer across from me and thinking to myself after a long shift, my God, I hope I never look like that. And then we got out of the tunnel, and that person disappeared because it was my own reflection.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know, and I realized that if I didn't get off the ramp, that I was going to die there.
Huh.
And somebody gave me a piece of advice once on the ramp. That was one of the best pieces of advice that I'd ever gotten, but also one of the hardest, which is that you have to have a skill. If you're skilled labor, it's a very different world than if you don't have a skill. And so at first I tried to become a pilot, but that proved to be way too expensive. So I sold my pilot gear and I bought myself a used PowerBook, the first titanium PowerBook, which was a couple years old at that point. Bought it on eBay and taught myself to code between flights, basically, and working with a colleague of mine who was doing kind of the same thing with design. We ended up making a proof of concept online training system that we deployed at the airline, saving them a ton of money.
Excellent.
And getting jobs programming.
Great.
And so I found myself for the first time in my life in this white-collar job where I actually got paid to use my brain and not to lift things, where my life was not in peril every single day. But I somehow just, you know, wanted more, wanted to go further. It wasn't enough to work in the enterprise. I wanted to actually, you know, do more. I wanted to make products, you know. I wanted to follow in the footsteps of the people who I admired, the people who had changed the world with software. Mm. And so I ended up, when I had the opportunity to take an early retirement package because of the foibles of the airline industry, I left and I went to the Apple Worldwide Developer Conference. And there I met Will Shipley, who, of course, is the founder of the Omni Group and Delicious Monster, the creator of you know, Delicious Library and any number of other things, one of the most successful software engineers of all time, and one of the, I would say, just the inventors of the notion of product engineering when it comes to software. You know, you can almost measure applications in terms of before and after Delicious Library. Hmm. And so when I met him, I knew that that was the mentor that I needed. And so I sacrificed everything. I sold my house. I got rid of everything that I owned. I ultimately ended up losing my wife. And I moved into his basement, which was a room so small that it was room for my bed and the door to open. And that was all.
Wow.
I lived there for a year. I worked for him for free. And then for 2 years, I lived in the apartment across the street from his and worked for him for another 2 years for just about nothing, because what he was paying me in was not money, but knowledge and experience, not just of how to code, but how to code massive code bases, how to make products, how to think about people, how to do business, how to conduct business, weird lessons that you would think have nothing to do with business until you realize that they do. A real kind of, you know, Pat Morita in the Karate Kid kind of situation where it's like you think this guy's messing with you, and then one day you realize that you have game.
Awesome.
When the iPhone came out, I knew that's what I wanted to do. So I left after that three-year apprenticeship, winning a design award with my team, and I went to Silicon Valley. To get together with some crazy guys in jailbreak to create what became Tapulous and TapTap Revenge and so on and so forth.
Nice, yeah. Man. And are you still writing apps for the iPhone?
You know, I don't have time to write as much code as I would like. And it's actually really funny because a lot of times, you know, I do this after damn thing full time. Mm. I mean, I really do. And when I run out of money because I don't get paid to do it, you know, I write some code and get some money and then go back to it, basically.
Interesting.
Because, you know, I mean, the thing is, we make a lot of money for what we do. On an hourly basis, and so you can, you know, you can do 2 weeks of work, and if you live simply enough, that can sustain you for, you know, 6 months. Mm. And the key is living simply. I mean, I own almost nothing. I have a very simple life. I've learned to discard material possessions and to take my joy in experiences, because not only are experiences so much greater, so much broader, so much better, but they actually make you a better person. Whereas material possessions, they weigh you down. Mm. You know, you own all of this stuff and you think that that defines you, and then you find yourself in a situation where you're spending all this money to store this stuff. You're paranoid about it being stolen. You're suddenly worrying so much about what everybody else is doing and how they're trying to take your stuff away. Once you have nothing to lose, the world is a much friendlier place.
Interesting. That's an excellent point, man. I think you can translate that to... but not as interestingly in the software world, but those are great stories, man. That's very inspiring.
But you know,
inspiring.
It's not. It does kind of apply in software, because one of the things that I learned, and one of the things that a lot of people are learning, you know, not just something that I've made up, but something that sociologists actually study, is the way that we used to do things on the Mac, which is starting to be the way that we do things on the iPhone, and even the way that we just do things in the kind of app industry in general. We help each other. Our so-called competitors, we share code with them, we share knowledge with them. Mm. You know, the metaphor that I use is if we're all running a race and trying to trip each other, we're never going to break the world record. But we can help each other while still maintaining our own sort of competitive edge, right? It's the secret sauce formula. Hmm. 80% of what we do is really not important to our business. It's just stuff we have to do, you know, performance, data persistence. I mean, these are not the things that we build our business on. These are just the things that people expect. We have our hook, we have our secret sauce, we have that vision that we have that sets us apart from our colleagues. Mm. They're not competitors, they're colleagues, because we have so much more in common, people who make great products, than we do to fight about. Mm-hmm. We cooperate with each other, and somehow this turns out to be good business.
Mm. Can you make money writing open source code?
I mean, how much money has Apple made off of Unix, for example? I mean, this is where that secret sauce formula really comes in, because it kind of informs the relationship between what open source and what closed source should be. Mm. I think the mistake is when people try to be extreme in one way or the other and say that everything needs to be open or everything needs to be closed. The reality is, again, I think 80% of what we do is not that important and it should be shared. JSON library, for example. I mean, that's a perfect example of something that should be open source because it's something we all need and should all be contributing to.
Okay.
But then that hook, that thing that's going to set you apart, that thing that's going to make customers say, wow, I want to buy this app, right? That special sauce, that relationship that you as a developer form with your customers, not the back-end technology, the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That's the closed part. Right? That's the secret sauce. That's that layer of frosting on top that makes the cake that much sweeter. So I think that open source has its place, and when I say it has its place, I mean it has its place in making money, right? Mm-hmm. But then so does closed source.
Excellent. Now, let's talk a little bit about, you know, with so much going on, I'm sure you keep well aware of what's going on around you in the developer world, even though you may not be writing a lot of code these days.
I hope so, anyway.
You're full on in there. Mm-hmm. What do you see as some of the biggest problems facing developers?
The absolute biggest problem facing us right now is this patent situation, because it threatens the entire industry. And it's, you know, anybody who thinks that they're not affected by this does not understand what's happening here. Because this is not, it's not an American issue, it's not an iPhone issue, it's not a mobile issue. It is an issue that affects our very industry, and not just the software industry, ultimately the creative industry, right? Because again, getting back to the secret sauce model, there's this idea of intellectual property of the commons, right? People who think that great ideas are sort of fully formed and fall out of your backside are people who have never really built anything great. When you really look at great things, you see that what they are composed of is things that have already existed. Mm-hmm. And so in order for us to continue to create, we have to always be contributing to the commons and not taking from the commons. Mm-hmm. It works just like the environment, right? You have a relationship with the environment, and that relationship is either going to be a healthy relationship that is sustainable forever, or it's going to be a detrimental relationship that actually takes away from the common. So you might make money, but the guy who comes after you and the guy who comes after him are going to be unable to, because there's nothing left for them. Hmm. We are in a situation where we're fighting for the very soul of our industry. Are we going to have an industry that is set up in such a way that we can continue to practice what we do? And ultimately what we are practicing is doing what we love. Are we still going to be able to do that, or are we going to be selfish and short-sighted, trying to carve bits of the commons off for ourselves, trying to protect, you know, things from other people who are going to come in, and trying to screw future generations? I just think that that's bad business.
What exactly is it that Amsterdam does to help protect developers from these so-called attacks?
Sure. So first of all, you have to understand that, you know, what this is extortion, right? Mm. Extortion is what happens when somebody comes up to you and says, it's nice what you've built here, it would be a shame if something bad were to happen, right? And so the idea is that you don't want to know what they mean by that. And so you're going to go ahead and just cooperate with them, because that's the easiest thing to do. But you're making a deal with the devil. Right? And so the first thing that we do is we take a serious look at these materials, because the thing is, we don't know who's being sued, and we don't know what materials they've received, because people are terrified. Mm-hmm. And so we've managed to find people who are willing to share these things with us so that we can share them with everybody, so that we can say, this might happen to you, and this is what's going to happen. This is what the materials look like. You have to read them, because there's all these little catches in there. For example, I didn't know this, right? Because when you're reading the contract, for example, like the typical arrangement is something like, what is it, like, it's like half a percentage of your sales above like $10,000, right? And you might look at that and say, maybe it's just the cost of doing business. But what you don't realize is that in order to make sure that you're following that, you also have to open your books whenever they want. Right? I mean, you really are making a deal with the devil. Mm-hmm. It is not the easiest thing to do, to give into extortion. The other thing is that the way that these patent trolls work, they work on an efficiency system, right? They use as little energy as possible to attack as many people as possible. Mm. You have to understand that. And if you give in, you're giving them the fuel that's going to allow them to roll and continue rolling over other people. And so it's important that we fight. And it's important that we not do the opposite, which is to deny, you know, to ignore that letter. That's the worst possible thing you can do, because then you're talking about summary judgments, and basically you've just given up. You've surrendered without doing anything. What you need an attorney. and you need knowledge. You need to not be scared. So the first thing that we do is we give people information, because information is the cure for fear. And then once we have that, we give them an attorney. An attorney who will be able to deal with them on a sort of group basis and give group rates. And an attorney who is not doing this simply because of the money, but because they too see their industry threatened by abusive use of things like intellectual property, right? I mean, intellectual property is this two-edged sword. It's what allows us to eat from the things that we make, but it also is used to prevent us from making things in the first place, right? And so, that you know, we have to strike this balance. You know, and that's just what we're doing for that. The broader question that inevitably follows is, what exactly is Amsterdam? What does Amsterdam do?
Yes.
Right? In a nutshell, Amsterdam is a nonprofit meta-organization that represents the interests of app makers worldwide. Now, what does that mean? We're literally a nonprofit organization.
Cool.
You know, chartered in the Netherlands. We have a board of, you know, five representatives of the community, as it were. We have a crew of volunteers. And we are, you know, nobody's getting paid for this. You know, our charter allows us to pay one person, and that's the accountant who makes sure that we continue to exist as a company. The rest of us, including myself, we get no money for this. Mm-hmm. Our stock options, if you will, is the fact that we have businesses that operate in the community. And so if the community does well, then we all do well. Mm-hmm. And that's the idea. That's what we mean by a meta organization. So who is Amsterdam? It's all of the app makers. And that means all of the app makers. You know, that means not just the startups. It means the big guys like Microsoft and Google who are in on this with us. It means the, you know, smaller companies that are just kind of local, you know, everything from a one-man shop to a, you know, 300-seat agency. Mm-hmm. We serve startups, you know, people who are trying to get into the whole entrepreneur scene, people who are trying to close funding, but we also serve indies. We also serve employees, right? Like, the reality is, if you're a person who makes software, you have more in common with us than you do with pretty much anybody else. It doesn't really matter if you're an entrepreneur or an indie, and it doesn't really matter if you're an engineer or a designer or a business developer or a marketer or a lawyer, because building a business requires all of those people. And it's not a matter of one platform. It's all about every platform, right? It is the universal meeting ground where we can all come. It is an organization that is meant to represent the interests of all of us, all app makers everywhere, to find things that work for a company like Microsoft, but also for one guy in his garage shipping some software just so that he can feed his family, right? It is that common ground. We basically, our API, we have one method, what do you need? We provide what app makers need. We have a speaker training program, for example. So if maybe you are, you know technology, but you're not so good at talking about technology, we have that available to you. So you can get that kind of training, the same training that I was taught to give to Apple's engineers for their Worldwide Developer Conference when I worked there. We have lectures every Wednesday. We have workshops that we put on to help you know, people be trained. We brought the Big Nerd Ranch, the biggest name in technical training that I've ever heard of. You know, they've moved to Amsterdam to start retraining people. So if you're a technical person or you're interested in apps, or you're in an industry that's been affected by apps, like publishing, for example, and you want to find out what the app situation is, you want to get retrained, you can come to Amsterdam, and we have all of these resources there to retrain you. The idea is that we can build a technical labor surplus, and that's going to attract other skilled companies who can never find enough good people. The idea is the idea that has been the idea of Amsterdam for centuries, which is for the best people in the world to come together, to share their best, to blend their cultures, and to take that home with them, so that we can all, as a massive global ecosystem, which is really what we are, we can learn to work together. We don't have to look to one valley in California as where technology comes from. We can figure out how to crack that code, how to make something even better than that, how to build that kind of ecosystem everywhere. And we'll have that center of gravity. We'll have that capital. So that Silicon Valley becomes not a place, but an idea. In fact, even an outmoded idea, because what we've built is even better than that, right? We're not just about startups, we're about everybody. We're not just about, you know, going to work 80 hours a week, 90 hours a week. We're about families, right? We actually have family get-togethers every other weekend so that our families can get to know each other. Having myself gone through a technology-related divorce, I don't want that to happen to people. Mm. I don't want people to end up like Steve Jobs, having their children not know them because they're at work all the time.
Sure.
You know, our families can meet each other and support each other the same way that, for example, military families do when they do what we do, which is we go away, right? Because when we're working on projects, we're not there.
Mm.
You know, and it's not because we're being forced to, it's because that's just how we are. You know, we have something inside of us that has to come out, and it's not going to let us rest until we do. Mm-hmm. But our families suffer when that happens, and we have to recognize that, and we have to do something about that. Mm-hmm. All of these things, everything that app makers need to do their business, to live their lives, that is what we do.
Amazing, man. Excellent. Well, hey, thanks for sharing this with Channel 9.
My genuine
and
pleasure.
And it's great to meet you, Mike.
Likewise.
And next time I'm in Amsterdam, I'm going to have to look you guys up.
I expect it.
Right on, man.
Cheers.
Cheers.